there July 18th to witness the greatest four-day political convention of all time, the 40th Republican National Convention in Cleveland, Ohio, featuring a legendary lineup of heroes and patriots, including the robot from Small Wonder, race realist Wonka, Lindy England, family folk group Zyklon Bay, Baron Vladimir Harkonnen, live via satellite, Anders Bering Breivik, Twitter user, Gundam Mussolini 69, Kevin Trudeau, teaching delegates the Mega Memory System, Pinhead, Sam Ace Rothstein and the Sheldon Adelson Dancers, trapeze artists, the Flying Pepes, the ceaseless, anguished cries of the unjustly slain, rising in a chorus of ecstatic suffering, and plenty more. Also, get your laugh on at the Fresh Ass Comedy Tent, featuring Yakov Smirnoff, Gallagher smashing a watermelon with Black Lives Matter written on it, Jeff Dunham debuting his new puppet, Mohammed the Transgendered Terrorist, Larry the Cable Guy's more aggro cousin, Mervin the Blackwater Contractor. There'll be plenty of other fresh attractions, including wall-building demos, Pinochet helicopter rides, Breitbart's Beach Boys BBQ Blowout Bash Blast, and much, much more. It's the 40th Republican National Convention, the closest thing to Shangri-La on Earth, but less gay.
It's Chapo, everybody. It's episode 24. That was our rundown of the lineup of this year's Republican National Convention. But Matt, you're going to Cleveland with our friend our buddy Brian. It's Lit Fam in Cleveland.
Oh my god, I'm so excited. I mean, I don't have any illusions of getting anywhere near the convention because this thing is locked down. We're going to be in, you know, the protest free speech zones that are literally miles away. But there is one chance to mingle with regular folks that I'm looking forward to on Monday. There's going to be an all-day rally at a park near the lake, co-sponsored by Roger Stone and hosted by Alex Jones.
Awesome.
That I'm very excited about. It's sponsored by a number of white genocide believing white nationalist organizations.
Matt, could you please try to get Roger Stone or Alex Jones to say dicks out for Harambe?
Absolutely. I'm going to try to get everybody to say that. I'm also going to try to, if I see Roger Stone, I'm going to beg him to show me his Nixon back tat. I really want to see that.
Yeah, the Republican convention, it's like I said, it's going to be Lit Fam.
And I got to say that, you know, we were doing a little joke there at the beginning with our lineup, but it's not that much more ridiculous than the actual one.
Yeah. Yeah, before we start the show, I'm looking at some of the people who actually are scheduled to be at the Republican National Convention, and the very first one is someone named Jameel Shaw Sr., and it says, whose son was killed by an undocumented immigrant and who supports stronger border control.
He's going to go up there and literally wave a bloody shirt. It's going to be amazing.
Yeah, that's pretty low. Also, I did see today that Scott Baio is going to be addressing the convention.
Baio. Can you believe it?
That's not a joke.
They landed Baio.
I know we said... and then one of the early nights in the convention, I swear to God, is called A Night of Benghazi.
Yep.
And they're going to have, like many of the Benghazi survivors.
I know Oz is going to be there. Yeah? The guy who did that amazing ad for him where he's in the cemetery, like,
oh,
Hillary Clinton?
He's like, I know.
No, thank you.
That was the NRA commercial. Yes, yes. He was like, thinking of who you're going to vote for in November? I know some folks who ain't going to be voting at all. All these graves behind me.
It's also, as a Wisconsinite, I'm very proud because we've got two reps coming in. And Scott Walker is going to be there later. But then on Monday, we've got David Clark, who's like this insane black conservative
he's the sheriff
from Milwaukee County.
He's the anti-hip-hop sheriff,
yes.
The anti-Black Lives Matter sheriff.
And also Representative Sean Duffy, who is from Western Wisconsin. And people may remember from an early season of The Real World.
Oh,
he's
wow.
He's a literal real-world cast member who is now in the House of Representatives and married to another Real World cast member, Rachel, from the San Francisco season. So, you know, this is really the spectacle eating itself. I'm pretty excited about it.
Felix, this one's for you, buddy. July 19th, who's addressing the convention?
Oh, yeah.
None other than Dana White, president of Ultimate Fighting Championship.
All right, so this one, it actually kind of irritates me a little bit because, yeah, so Dana White is big, and the Fertittas, who just sold the UFC, they're big Trump backers. And it reminded me of how Matt brought up the Ace Rothstein dancers, and they're definitely in that, like, mobbed-up Vegas element. But Dana White speaking means that because of his personal enmity with Tito Ortiz, also a big Trump supporter, that Tito won't speak, which is a fucking shame, because if you remember from our MMA show, Jordan Breed,
we established he cannot speak.
Yeah, Tito Ortiz is, like, he cannot figure out how to get words out of his mouth without tripping over his own cock. Tito Ortiz, one time, for people who haven't seen this video, he called a press conference to make a non-announcement about his fighter having a fight that never happened, and fucked up every single thing he was supposed to say, and then bragged to the reporters that he bought a party sub to cater the press conference. And, like, I was just, the moment that I saw him at the Trump rally earlier this year, I was like, oh yeah, dude, he's gonna fucking speak at the convention. Because him, he likes Trump, he was on Celebrity Apprentice, but because Dana White, who they both hate the shit out of each other, is speaking, we're not gonna get treated to Tito.
The other professional athlete I see on the roster here is Natalie Gulbis, who's a professional golfer.
She's the hot golfer. That's like her shtick.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, she wears bikinis
awesome.
And stuff. Yeah.
I like it. And then, real quick before we start the show, do you guys have any thoughts on Trump's VP selection, Mike Piss?
Do you see this? Fuck it. Hey, guys. He ate at Applebee's. We should kill him. He should die. He should die. Big if true, am I right? Am I fucking right? Big and true.
Those chain restaurants in Manhattan are fucking incredibly expensive. Yeah. And the people who eat at them are pretty well-heeled tourists. And it just goes to show that all the cultural war bullshit, the stuff that really, like, gets people charged up. Because you know that they did that on purpose. They showed him and his family, oh, we're loving Chili's in New York. So people would be like, eating Chili's in New York, you fucking hick. And that's exactly what they wanted. But of course,
right, but
the people who eat Chili's in New York are fucking, they're solidly middle class, at least. Yeah, these cultural signifiers are totally, class signifiers are totally removed from actual income anymore. It's all just,
Mike Pence,
just a symbol.
Mike Pence doesn't really eat that. Mike Pence has a meal where his wife, like, she puts a Cornish game hen inside a turkey, and it's supposed to represent a viable fetus.
I have to say that I'm a little worried about Mike Pence becoming vice president, because if he gets enough influence to pass the law where I have to hold a funeral every time I jerk off, that's too much time out of my day. I'm sorry. I'm not going to do that.
I feel guilty enough as it is.
I'm not burying those Kleenexes.
I was
going to
say,
no, I'm sorry. Not happening.
The only thing I that sticks out in my head about Mike Piss is that as governor of Indiana, he presided over, and this is just last year, the single largest HIV outbreak in America since the 1980s.
You did it, fam!
190 cases in one town alone.
Don't call it a comeback!
There's one more thing I want to say about the RNC, though. One, you've got his family members, Trump's family members are speaking to the point where it's like, either it's just his narcissism or they couldn't get anybody else. So you've got, you know, his daughter, his wife, Eric, the creepy blonde one, and also Lynn Patton, who is vice president of the Eric Trump Foundation. it's
Eric
just
Trump
like
Foundation.
It's some sort of stitch up. It's like a scam thing. You know, the degree to which these people are like, God knows how many Trump entities are charging exorbitant fees to the Republican National Convention for like utensils or whatever. And then my favorite thing is that fucking Peter Thiel is speaking on Thursday, which, just the thought behind that, how are we going to get our message across to middle America? I know, we're going to have a bloodless, psychopathic German show up and tell them about how they need to reconcile themselves to slavery in the new brave future, where he's just going to be a giant head on a robot body with a giant laser whip making you mine for him.
I was a cruise boater.
I think you should reconsider yourself in the future. You will be fuel for me. You will power my slipstream. I will suck stem cells out of your spine and drink them.
Oh, well, okay, man, if you say so.
That guy's a job creator.
So, that's the Republican convention. Matt will be going there to Cleveland with Brian. We'll be discussing that next week. But that was a long-ass cold open, so I think we should just go ahead and start the show. What do you say?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, we got a lot to discuss today. Roll that chopper. All I wanna be is okay, we are back. It's episode 24, the Jack Bauer episode. I'm Will Meneker. Joining me, as always, Felix Biederman.
Hey, everybody.
And Matt Chrisman.
Sup?
Now, if you're a subscriber in our previous show, in episode 23, you witnessed us take a deep dive into the Adam Sandler 9/11 film, Rain Over Me. The reviews have been pouring in for that. My impression of Adam Sandler has been called uncannily accurate. I will not do it for you now. You have to subscribe to hear the show. But on that, we mentioned that we also wanted to discuss the Gerard Butler action film London Has Fallen. Unfortunately, that segment had to be bumped today because a real-life action movie popped off on Friday. I'm talking about the failed coup attempt in Turkey. Guys, I'm not trying to be glib at all, though, but seriously, do you know what the coup attempt in Turkey reminds me of?
What?
Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
All kidding aside, back in, just sort of randomly in episode one, we've decided to make Erdogan and the AKP party sort of a returning character on the show. And when this happened on Friday, I think we had to resist our initial urge to make a joke out of it. But I, in all sincerity, I think we felt that we did need to discuss, do this issue justice and not just become...
And development. Well,
yeah, exactly. We want to give this issue justice and development and not be like the people we make fun of, like Matt Iglesias, who when something important happens in the world and literally has nothing to say about it, rather than just shutting up, will just say something asinine. So we wanted to give this issue justice, so we're going to be talking with our old friend Derek Davison about what's going on in Turkey.
I mean, and to remind everyone, we didn't do it.
Yeah, exactly. This is not a viral marketing stunt for the show.
Yeah, I mean, like, what we are trying to say here is there are things that are funny, like homophobia, racism, etc., that it's okay to make fun of. But when things actually affect people's lives, Chapo gets serious, and we did.
So, yes, the Chapo foreign policy correspondent, Derek Davison. Let's go. Okay, we are joined now by Derek Davison, our returning champion, the first ever two-time Chapo guest, our Turkey expert, our Iran expert, American Samoa expert, and Trap House foreign policy correspondent, Derek.
He is our Max Boot.
It's Joey Sneaker.
Yeah, there you go.
Yo, it's Steve Tevis.
I just finished mowing down my lawn the way that Sultan Tayyip will mow down the enemies of the Turkish state.
Well, I mean, when you cut the grass, you see the snakes. So they say.
No, Derek, obviously, we thanks for coming on short notice. We
sure
are like everyone hostage to the great weight of history as it happens, and we wanted to get you on as soon as possible to hopefully help us make sense of. We're recording this on a Saturday, mind you. This is Saturday, the 16th, right now.
Yes, so, this is good because anything that winds up being proven wrong, I need to have some.
Yeah. You will not be held accountable for anything said today on Saturday the 16th. But, Derek, and as best you can describe, like, what the hell happened last night in Turkey?
I mean, as far as it seems, this was a very poorly conceived hatchet job of a coup attempt by a faction of a faction, basically, inside the Turkish military that may have been connected to the Gulenist movement, which I'm sure we can talk about, although Erdogan blames the Gulenists when he runs out of coffee in the morning. So, you know, he blames them for everything. So you can't be
now.
Entirely...
One more time. For maybe there are new listeners. Who are the Gulenists and who is Gulen?
Fethullah Gulen is he was a preacher in Turkey for a couple of decades. I mean, he's, you know, lived in Turkey for a long time. Very active in the 70s and 80s, preaching a moderate, sort of moderate Islamism, like the idea that Islam should be more involved in Turkish life and Turkish politics, but not, you know, when you think of, we're sort of trained in America now, when you hear the word Islamist or Islamism, you think, you know, ISIS or something, but, you know, he wasn't, you know, it's not, his brand of Islam is not that sort of hardcore fundamentalist.
It's sort of like
Islam.
It's sort of like a conservative Christianity in America. It's Islam and religion.
It's even. I mean, it's even a little more tolerant than that. I think it's you know, it's more interfaith
and you can still wear like moderate suits and ties and stuff.
Right. So he's been active in the 70s and 80s, especially building this network of organizations, mostly charter schools, is what he's known for. That and his preaching. Then in the 90s, as Turkey started to move slowly out of the era of having a military coup once every 5 to 10 years, which we can talk about, Gulen and Tayyip Erdogan, worked together to sort of bring Islam into the public sphere in a controlled, kind of managed way, so as not to antagonize what's called the deep state, which is, you know, the Turkish intelligence and security apparatus and the military.
Why would bringing Islam more to the fore of politics in Turkey antagonize the deep state?
Well, okay, so when you think of the history of the Republic of Turkey, there are similarities, I find, between Turkey and Israel in this sense, because you always hear about, or you've heard about the last couple of years, Israel, you know, and trying to decide whether it favors its Jewishness more than its democracy or its democracy more than its Jewishness. There's these two factors to the state, these two elements to the state that it you know, it was founded as a Jewish democracy, but they've come into conflict. So in Turkey, back in, you know, at the end of World War I, Mustafa Kemal Atatürk founded the Republic of Turkey as a secular democracy coming out of the ashes of the Ottoman Empire.
And basically in one fell swoop, secularized the entire country.
Yes. I mean, you know, the Ottoman Empire went through fits and starts in terms of how religious it was. But by that point, yes. I mean, this is sort of, you know, he did away with the empire. He established a republic and explicitly established it to be a non-religious political entity. But the rest of Turkish history since then has been dominated by the tension between the public's desire to get away from, not entirely away from secularization, and not the entire public, but to sort of find a way to bring its Islamic character, because, you know, Islam and Turkishness have always been very, very, very closely connected. And so there's a substantial portion of the Turkish population, and has been, you know, for almost a century now, that's been kind of pushing back a little bit on the idea that this has to be an entirely secular republic, that we can't even talk about or incorporate Islam into the political sphere in any way. And so there have been a series of military coups. There have been at least four, and some people say five, before the whatever happened last night, that have happened any time the Turkish civilian government looks like it's starting to flirt with you know, more religious bent, the military has stepped in and put a stop to it.
And do you think that that was the motivation behind what happened on Friday night?
Well, I don't. It's hard to say. There have been a lot of changes in the past, you know, almost 20 years since the last time. The last time they did a coup, which wasn't even really a coup. I think they sent a memo, and the government collapsed. They didn't even.
That's
they
a hell of a memo,
barracks, right? I mean, they just wrote a memo, and that was the end of that. But what happened in the late 90s was the whole Turkish political establishment basically was interested in joining the EU. Okay, still is, although Erdogan, you know, waffles about it, but there's still a lot of interest in the Turkish establishment, at least, in joining the EU. And by some very explicit EU bylaws, if you're the kind of country that has a military coup every decade, you can't get in. You just can't get membership. And so there was sort of this unspoken agreement, I think, that was worked out in the late 90s between people like Erdogan and Gulen and a couple of the other, you know, leading founders of the Justice and Development Party, who have sort of now been purged by Erdogan as he's consolidated his control. But they sort of made this unspoken arrangement with the military that, look, you know, if you give us some space to be a little more, to incorporate religion a little more into the public sphere, without snapping back and holding another coup, which would, you know, screw up our plans to join the EU. If you can allow us that space, we'll make sure that we don't get carried away and take it so far that you feel you have no choice. The military has always seen itself, the Turkish military has always seen itself as the defender of Ataturk's original ideals for the state. He was a military man. I mean, he was he almost single-handedly pulled that country out of World War I, and then the war that followed to establish Turkey and keep the Europeans from parceling it out. So he was a national military hero, and he was, you know, he is revered not just by the people of Turkey as their sort of George Washington figure, but especially by the military. And they've always seen themselves as the defenders of this idea of the secular republic. So that's why they keep intervening, and that's why, you know, this, like I say, sort of informal or unspoken arrangement was conceived in the late 90s. But what's happened since then is Erdogan has basically just been accumulating more and more and more and more power for himself, and doing it in ways that are more and more explicitly Islamic, like are more explicitly Islamist.
Well, I wanted to ask about that because, like, my thought was, I had that same thought about the history of the secular deep state sort of stepping in when it felt like there was some sort of a threat to it. But wasn't there a huge prosecution early in the AKP rule, like early 21st century, where there was
right.
the Erdogan, Erdogan or whatever? How important was that in sort of maybe clearing out the real threats to Erdogan? And, like, what is the likelihood that it could have like persisted since then in order to carry something like this out?
You're talking about the Ergenekon trials. They were a series of procedures, legal proceedings against some top military officers, opposition politicians, anybody who was seen as sort of an agent of the deep state and opposed to Erdogan and AKP. And this did have the effect of clearing out a lot of the old guard military officers. So the top levels of the Turkish military are guys who were put there by Erdogan, who replaced guys who were arrested and prosecuted by Erdogan. This is why it's hard to say that what happened was an action by the deep state, because the officer corps of the Turkish military is not particularly connected with that deep state anymore. These are, as I say, guys who are Erdogan's guys. And it also is part of the reason why the attempt failed. They completely failed to get any kind of subsequent buy-in from the rest of the military, which is really, you know, kind of essential when you're trying to take over a state. Yeah,
well, yeah. I want to talk about that.
Any coup is going to be, you know, started by a faction, but the trick is to create a snowball effect, right? You step out and you know, declare you're taking over the state, and you get, you know, people coming to your side.
Now, yeah, actually, I wanted to talk about this. I mean, we saw some, you know, pretty incredible footage from the other night of soldiers shutting down bridges, firing at people from helicopters. I should say, it seemed like the troops were firing on people in an attempt to get them to disperse, not so much to cause mass casualties or, I mean, it was still terrifying. But what exactly did this, like, how exactly did they try to pull this off is what I'm wondering. Erdogan was apparently out of the country when this happened, and they decided that if we just shut down airports and the border and then try to take parliament or something, we can hold them off long enough. Or let's do some coup making 101 here.
Well, that was the Musharraf playbook, right? That's how they took power. He took power in Pakistan while Nazif was out of the country, if I remember correctly.
Right. I don't think Erdogan was out of the country, though. I think he was
on
vacation.
That's the thing. I'm hearing he's on vacation. It's like they didn't try to get him. That blows my mind that they didn't try to arrest him.
It's, you know what it reminds me of? It reminds me of the really stupid Max Fisher article where he writes an open letter to the Syrian army.
Yeah, the Syrian thing. I was thinking about that too.
Yeah, wait till Assad goes on vacation and he turns on his timed light, and then you put a bucket of water above his head, above the doorframe, and he's going to get soaked. And then you're the president.
I totally thought about that, too. That's hysterical.
Well, like I said, it worked for Musharraf. So, I mean, if you don't have enough of a popular base, it can work. You're just like, yeah, he's gone. Pucci died on the way to his home planet. But it certainly seems like they definitely underestimated the degree of popular support for AKP, especially in the cities. Because I was thinking, like, oh,
yes,
he's calling for people in Istanbul to come out to the streets and fight for him. Fuck that. His base is in the heartland. But they were out there.
Yes.
No, yeah, they came out strong for him. And I did not expect that at all.
Well, do you think that they came out strong for Erdogan in particular? Or do you think they just came out for the concept of democracy and that they didn't want their, you know, military takeover of their government?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to say. But I've seen people make that argument that it looked like genuine AKP support.
Well, because remember, the AKP is sort of like the center-right conservative religious party. So I saw some videos, and I could tell that those were definitely AKP supporters because they were rolling coal while they were driving to the protest zones.
Yeah, they were listening to the Turkish Toby Keith and Dierks Bentley. I'm getting taweed on a plane.
The theory now, and I've seen some more support for this morning, and people claims from the Turkish government is that it was our good old friend Gulen, that there was an order basically for a roundup of the remaining Gulenists in the army that was going to go out like today, and this was basically their last card to play. They knew that it was over basically, and they knew they were either going to take the government or they were all going to get purged.
That very well may be. It's the Gulenists. It's never been thought that they had a big foothold in the army. The theory has always been they've got more support in the among the judiciary and the police. But Erdogan's purged a lot of that.
Yeah, I mean, it really did feel like a spontaneous, almost like a improvised thing. Like basically, we'll take the TV, seize Istanbul and Ankara, and we'll just say we're in charge now, and sort of almost let the traditions of coups in Turkey take them over and give them the sort of implicit mandate from that.
You know, if you're going to try something like this, you got to have a figure to step in and say, "I'm in charge now. You know, I'm running the country."
Derek, hold on. I'm gonna disagree with you slightly there. Did you see the woman they made read the statement on TV? Though
I did not. Straight up dime. All right.
You know what? The entire TV station thing made me think, though. I thought, wow, Turkey is really quite behind in propaganda. Because when the AKP dance troops came to America, they did Nick Cannon's Wild and Out. And then we're like, America plus Turkey equals truth. And I go, how are you supposed to deny genocide with that? That doesn't work. And then when these guys took over the TV station, they basically have the barrel of the gun in the woman's ear.
Yes, I am sure. Sure as sure can be.
Oh my God, what happened to your fingers?
Boating accident.
I believe it was a boating accident. I have to go now.
And right. The statement okay. She's reading is like, everything is great. The soldiers are in charge now.
How can this inspire
confidence in anyone? They need to hire some better propagandists. They need to fully put us on the payroll. We're just Matt and Will are just independent contractors.
There you go.
Now.
Well, I want to defend the coup plotters in one thing. I think Matt, you said that they didn't go after Erdogan. Erdogan claims that they attacked his hotel, but he had already left.
That's a bungle.
He was in a hotel in Marmaris, I think, on the Aegean coast, vacationing. And he claims that about an hour after he left, there was a bombing at the hotel. I haven't seen that confirmed anywhere.
Well, that's pretty bad, though.
I think that's pretty bungling. It's very bad, but at least it shows that they.
I mean, I'd say you get him. You get him before you do anything else. I mean, am I crazy?
Well, I laughed at these guys. There were a couple of ex CIA guys who were doing the cable news rounds last night who were all like,
oh God, Bob Baer was out there with a fucking visible erection.
When I saw Bob Baer, it was like watching like sports radio, but about a coup.
You know what, Mike?
These flashy Gulanis hip hop divacos, they got the statement plan and they got their balaclavas on, but they don't want to do the hard work. That's what comes down to.
My favorite about Bob Baer on TV last night is he was like, I've been involved in several coups.
Right.
It was like, okay.
Yay, thanks. Woo-hoo.
My previous job, where I destabilized governments, by the way.
No, going about the other CIA guys, analysts on cable news now.
Well, no, it was the same thing. I mean, it's I know a thing or two about coups. Okay, but there is a process that there are sort of coup d'état best practices, right? And these guys didn't follow any of them. One is you either if you're not going to immediately get the leader of the country under your control or dead, then you at least have to make sure that the leader of the country is not very popular so that you will have massive outpourings of people in the streets supporting you instead of opposing you. But Erdogan is very popular. He's continually been very popular. Election after election sort of bears this out, that he's very, very popular.
And actually, I mean, this is worth mentioning. I mean, Erdogan is democratically elected. I mean, he is pretty much fair and square the leader of Turkey, correct?
Okay, so this is a little complicated. He's democratically elected. He's also shut down pretty much all opposition media. So that in itself kind of chips away at his legitimacy. But the other problem with that is, they had a parliamentary election last June, and AKP, for the first time since 2003, lost its sole majority in the parliament, and they were going to have to organize some kind of a coalition. I mean, they were still the largest party in the parliament, but they didn't have an outright majority. You know, they sort of half-heartedly attempted to make coalitions with a couple of the opposition parties who, were happy. They told, both the ultra-nationalists and the Kemalists, the CHP, said, we'd be happy to serve in a coalition with you as long as you reinstate all the corruption investigations against AKP members that you guys have put on ice. And so that was a non-starter for Erdogan and for AKP. So what he did instead is dramatically escalate the war against the Kurds for the next you know, 4 months. Then hold snap elections, declare that we can't form a coalition, we're going to have snap elections, while people were all sort of, you know, intensely whipped up into this sense of fear and nationalism because of the war against the Kurds. And then, you know, they won back. Not only did they win back their majority, I think they won they got a higher percentage of the vote than they've ever had. So he didn't exactly fix that election, but he definitely played around with it, right? I mean, he definitely manipulated it.
But yeah, again, so he's been slowly but surely becoming more and more, investing more and more authority in the executive power and in himself.
Right.
And becoming slowly more and more authoritarian. This brings us to where we're at now, right? So, like, okay, there was this sort of coup attempt, they took their shot, and they missed. And what you have now is, if he wasn't an authoritarian before, I mean, can you imagine what's going to happen
now? What are the odds that he shows up in the next few days for a press conference wearing the giant onion hat of a sultan of the Ottoman Empire?
Yeah, I mean, if you are a father of a very large boy anywhere in Eastern Europe,
yeah, you want to hide that kid.
Yeah, keep that boy close, because someone is going to take that boy for the new.
I gotta say, on this very show, Janissaries, we talk about how we bend reality. On this very show, I made the projection that in 2017 Putin would become czar again. And then in 1921 or 2021, Erdogan would become sultan again. I'll move that forward. Let's say that happens in 2016. But we're going to get a czar and a sultan having another Crimean war by the end of this decade.
I think there'll be one right after the other, because I think if one does it, the other one's going to have to do it.
Oh, yeah. He's going to have to.
It'll be like, yeah, you know, it'll be like when there were, you know, there was only one caliph in the Islamic world for centuries, and then somebody else declared that they were caliph, and then there were suddenly caliphs everywhere, because every little ruler in every part of the Islamic world had to be on the same level.
I want to go back to what I said just a second ago, is that, you know, this is it's a strange situation right now, where it's like an attempted military coup is pretty frightening, but a failed military coup against a guy like Erdogan is even more frightening in a lot of ways. Because I've following the news out of Turkey just this morning, and it seems like the guys who tried to pull this off are totally fucked. I mean, like, they're being rounded up as we speak. Several hundred judges have been arrested, and it's like, you know, Erdogan is back in town and he's pissed.
Yeah, I mean, I you know, I sort of was gaming this out as things were still a little bit up in the air, but kind of coming to a conclusion last night, and I said, you know, the worst thing that could have come out of this is that nothing got settled and you have some situation that devolves into a civil war. That's clearly not going to happen. But the other alternatives were sort of basically equally bad, which was either you were going to have this rump military junta with no support in any sector of Turkish, you know, of the Turkish state, trying to run the country, or you were going to have a newly empowered, you know, already pretty authoritarian minded Erdogan, who's now pissed on top of everything else. You know, that looks like the outcome, and it could be a bumpy ride. Now, if Erdogan's smart, you know, again, there's sort of, we're back to coup best practices now. It's sort of failed coup best practices, but, you know, it is possible to take it too far if you survive a coup and decide that you're going to, you know, purge the government of unfriendly elements. It is possible to go too far and wind up causing a second and much more serious coup. You know, as people start to think, well, you know, he's going crazy, and what if I'm next? If he's smart, he will
play it cool.
Play it cool. I mean, you know, you want to get rid of. You got to make an example of some people. You need to, you know, take some steps. And you're angry, and I don't blame him for being. I mean, you know, who wouldn't be angry? But
His vacation was fucked up.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, the guy's on vacation. He's in the resort.
He works hard. He gets 1 week a year. God damn it.
Well, if you're saying he needs to chill out and that's his best idea for the future, but he has today officially in front of a crowd in Turkey called for the U.S. to extradite Gulen.
I know.
So it looks like he's ready to precipitate an international incident as soon as he got back into power. So I'm kind of thinking he might not be too chilled out.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean,
he only gets that timeshare for so much time.
I want to ask,
fuck it all up.
This is something I still don't understand. Maybe this is information that's out there and I haven't seen it, and you'd be the one to let me know. I still don't know, like, how the Gulen-Erdogan breakup happened. Like, what were they specifically at odds about that led to this? Because they built the AKP together. They kind of created this revolution in Turkish politics, and this split has, like, defined so much of Turkish politics in the last couple of years and maybe even precipitated this bloody attempted coup. What was the cause of it?
Okay, so...
Does anyone really know that?
Their relationship started to go south after 2003. Now, 2002, the 2002 elections, AKP won its first parliamentary majority. Erdogan wasn't able to serve as prime minister right away because he was in some legal hot water, but that got cleared up and he eventually stepped in as prime minister. Gradually over the rest of that decade, he started to take some steps to counter the Gulen movement in Turkey. Especially, he started shutting down these charter schools, which I think is hitting Gulen basically right in the pocketbook.
It's also why D-Ray supports Gulen, but never mind.
And so in 2013, there was an investigation into some pretty serious corruption charges that looked like they were going to wind up in the lap of some AKP officials who were very close to Erdogan and maybe even wind up in the lap of Erdogan's sons. And Erdogan, maybe correctly, I mean, I think probably correctly, tied these investigations to Gulenist elements in the police and the judiciary. And that was when the first sort of purges started. That's when, they really had their falling out.
But for those not in the know, Gulen currently lives in Pennsylvania. And he's running a charter school network in America now. And this is why Erdogan wants the U.S. government to extradite him now because of this failed coup attempt. Now, this brings me to where does, like, the U.S. fit into all of this? Because now, Obama yesterday evening did issue a statement in support of Erdogan as the democratically elected leader.
Eventually.
It seems like it took him a long time to say anything.
Well, and the first statements that came out of the administration were about stability and, casualties, right. And they didn't say anything about which side we're taking. It was only really after it became apparent which way this was going.
Right.
That they sort of explicitly said, everybody needs to support the democratically elected government.
So from a U.S. perspective, if you're in the State Department or CIA or something like that, would there be a possible benefit to them of a coup overthrowing Erdogan?
I don't think this particular coup attempt would have, been good for them. But Erdogan has been a very challenging ally / problem for the administration. He's been so focused on, and this mostly has to do with Syria. I mean, his focus in Syria is, sort of 80% on the Kurds and another 15% on getting rid of Assad. And maybe 5% on doing anything about ISIS. The United States, in contrast, is 80% focused on ISIS and maybe 20% focused on getting rid of Assad. And we're actually working with the Kurds because they've been the most reliable in-country proxy force that the United States has had in terms of, you know, going after ISIS in northeastern Syria. Despite the fact that we've got this NATO relationship with Turkey, and we desperately have needed, and we're now able to use, but this was there was a fight for a long time about using Incirlik Air Base to launch airstrikes against ISIS in Syria. Despite all of these things, there's still this very considerable tension between what Ankara wants to happen in Syria and what the Obama administration is.
Now, you just mentioned the air base. I did just see before we got started this out that they have now completely shut down that air base, and all sorties against ISIS in Syria by NATO and the United States have been canceled. They can't take off or land at that air base in Turkey right now.
You know, this coup poses an analytical issue for quote-unquote anti-imperialists, many of whom think that the show is a deep state CIA operation, because obviously the first instinct is to say, oh, this is the CIA, totally, this is a U.S. coup.
I've seen many people say that.
But the problem is, for the real hardcore anti-imperialists, their narrative of this whole Middle Eastern situation is that the U.S. created ISIS with Erdogan and the Saudis, and so if we're overthrowing Erdogan because he's not doing enough about ISIS, that's a conflict. So good luck squaring that circle. That's all I have to say to those people.
But I worked for 2 years for the RAND Corporation, so clearly this is a deep state CIA
yes, definitely.
Broadcast, because you keep having me on.
We're through the looking glass, the people. Yeah,
I have seen people point out the fact that you're with the RAND Corporation.
I've seen it,
this
too.
Is, in fact, yeah.
The reverse vampires and the RAND Corporation have been working together, sponsoring this broadcast.
People who don't know, Derek is actually the cigarette-smoking man from the X-Files.
One more beat on the domestic front. I have to get your reaction to this hot take that came out of the events in Turkey yesterday. This is courtesy of Josh Rogan, half of the comedy duo Rogan and Lake.
Oh, no. Okay.
And his take is, he goes, okay, here goes. Obama ignored Syria, like arrows. Assad stayed. ISIS grew. Attacked Turkey. Weaken Erdogan, pave the way for the coup. # thanks, Obama.
Yeah,
can you follow
okay.
that? Can you follow that logic?
If you ever wanted to really root for 100% clean comedian Dan Nyman, he did in 2013 punch Josh Rogan, and every day you see why more and more.
I try, you know, Josh follows me on Twitter, so I try to be nice, but. Man, that is just the problem with all.
Like,
these
what is he
takes,
trying to
they,
say?
They
there?
Do this all the time. I mean, there's this funny story. Actually, can I digress for
please
like two
do.
Minutes? Okay, so I wrote a piece for Low Blog some months ago about, you know, he and Lake had done this big one of their periodic wails about Obama is shifting our Middle East policy in favor of Iran, and he's abandoning our allies. And I wrote this response. I said, look, you know, this is a neocon, you know, complaint, and it has no basis in reality. We're still, you know, providing huge support for the Saudis in Yemen, which is an operation that's totally contrary to U.S. national interest in almost every way, but we're still backstopping it for them because we haven't turned away from the Saudis. And he wrote to me, I think it was on Twitter, and said, you know, you've made a terrible mistake here. I'm not a neocon.
Okay, great.
Well, thanks. This is a thing that people like that do, where they try to make every bad thing that happens be about Obama's failure to, you know, invade, launch the glorious second half of the Iraq war and invade Syria. But the problem with all these analogies is all you have to do is take the logic back one more step to the fact that the invasion of Iraq was such a fucking stupid idea that totally destabilized the Middle East, and these guys were all in favor of it.
Well, I saw Eli Lake had a wonderful quip the other day. Or no, this is an article he wrote for Bloomberg that he sent out there, and the headline of which was, what the Iran deal supporters owe Iran's victims.
Oh, yeah, I love that.
We're diverting a bit from Turkey, but the past, like, 4 months have just been fucking sickening, because hundreds are dying in Baghdad just seemingly every week from attacks on Shia mosques and neighborhoods, and the attack in Nice, everything else, and every architect of the Iraq War, from Max Boot saying that it's his patriotic duty to go on vacation in France, to Eli Lake, I think, after Bataclan, said, all right, guys, you have to listen to us now. It's like, no, this, you helped give us this with Iraq. Like, if anything, every time one of these happens, you should be exiled to a more lonely and cold mountain, you fucking monster. But they think that every horrible consequence of the Iraq War gives them more license to talk somehow.
If we had overthrown Assad, Ahmed Chalabi would be still alive and ruling Syria, okay? You guys have no vision.
All right, what do you say? You want to leave it there, guys? Yeah, Derek, yeah. Thanks for coming on and helping us make sense of this.
Sure, happy to do it.
Cheers. Right, and your fruit basket for being a two-time Chapo nice. Guest is it's in the mail. All right. Guys, actually, leave the Audacity running. I just need to run to the bathroom and take a piss, mate.
I'm talking about piss, mate.
He's talking about urine, mate.
I'll be back in a second. Okay, I'm back.
Yeah.
Audacity's still running?
Yep.
Okay, that was some good piss. All right, we're back. That was Derek Davison, and you can check out his stuff at Loblaw and his personal blog, which we will link to in the show info. Again, that was we were talking about the failed coup attempt in Turkey, and this makes for an excellent segue into our discussion of the only other coup attempt that happened this week that was even more shoddily conceived of and doomed to failure than the one that happened in Turkey. But the good news is, because nobody died during this, we can make fun of it with a clear conscience.
I think a few people's dignity took a significant hit, but yes, no one was killed.
I am referring, of course, to the fire-ass open letter that was posted on Medium this week called We Are the Left, or as I like to call it,
we are revising today. It is July 17, 2016. Revision 87 for open letter, We Are the Left. We accidentally signed Tayyip Erdogan's name 500 times. The first letter of the 17th paragraph, if you take all the first letters, it says, kill all bi people. And we are trying to fix it. We apologize. We're so sorry. We're so sorry. We'll link your PayPal.
I'm sure you guys probably saw this. This was an open letter on identity politics to and from the left. This was this massive open letter that was signed by like 300 different people, but it's really basically someone had another manic episode and decided to write 6,000 fucking words on just relitigating all of this same stupid bullshit about people being mean to them throughout the course of the Democratic primary. But yeah, this is the brainchild of our good friends Sadie Doyle and Angry Black Lady, otherwise known as Imani Gandhi.
Dream team.
Yeah. I couldn't even read the entire fucking thing. And honestly, I mean, you already know what it's about. It's just a litany of complaints and thinly sourced anecdotes about, you know, how dude bros are, you know, abusing women and POC online under the guise of leftist socialist politics or something. Could you guys make it through at any of this at all?
I kind of like, it was like in Raiders of the Lost Ark, like it was too much truth and my face started melting by the time I got to paragraph 48, and they're like, and another thing, identity politics, here's what that means to me. And I was like, no, class is more important than race. I'm not white, I'm red. No. And then I had to break open and I have a glass case in my apartment and I smashed it open with a hammer and I immediately started harassing a woman so I could get my life force back. So no, I haven't read it.
The things that I was able to take away from it, from what I did read, is one, they create this, and I hate to use this term because it's the term of logic nerds, but it really is accurate in this case. They create a straw man. Yes, sometimes that does happen, where they say people are yelling, "Shut up about your identity. The only thing that matters is class." Very few people do that, other than unaccountable, random idiots, perhaps online, who these people insist are the responsibility of everyone else who they can claim shares their same politics, which is just an unworkable system of responsibility. So that's the one part of it. But the other part, and the part that I thought was even more interesting and more revelatory, is that the actual context for any of this conflict is completely removed. The fact that this was all in the context of a Democratic primary fight between a more left candidate and a less left candidate is totally – there's no mention of it. It's like the fighting over these broad categories as opposed to having a specific political difference over the future of who should lead the Democratic Party, the ostensible left party in America. That was the actual thing that this was all happening during, and there's nothing in the letter about it at all. So if you read that without knowing about it, you wouldn't even have any kind of context for what the disagreement was, which makes sense because they're trying to remove any kind of content from anything. They basically want the left to mean opportunities for their personal brand.
I mean, I think what they mean by identity politics and the way they use identity politics is just basically a means to shield themselves from any disagreement or criticism. And if they can always make the person criticizing them or making fun of them into a white cis dude bro, then they feel like they have the ace in the hole every time. And if it's not a white dude who's making fun of them or criticizing them or disagreeing with them, they'll just ignore them outright.
Well, you don't have to be a white dude to be a white dude. That's another bit of wisdom that we picked up during this time.
Now, to me, the greatest crime of this open letter was that virtually none of it was funny enough to read on the show. But what I will read is some of the corrections that happened after it, which is really...
That's my favorite part. Oh my God, it was so funny.
There's just like a whole number of problems that happened almost immediately after it was published. First, they... on the first draft of the letter, they included Marissa Johnson, who was the Black Lives Matter activist, or I don't know if she's associated with Black Lives Matter, but she was the activist who interrupted the Bernie rally in Seattle. And then people got mad at her, and they put her name onto the list of signatories. And then she claimed she never agreed to do this. They never consulted her. They just put her name.
Well, what's crazier is on this. She wasn't on the list of names at the beginning. What happened is that she was mentioned in the actual document as an example of a person of color being silenced and erased by white dude bros. But then she objected to that because she didn't give permission for her story to be used, which that's a weird model for.
Yeah, why do you need permission? It's a matter of the public record.
That's why this is an unworkable model, because yeah. Everybody has to Venmo everybody every minute that they want to talk to them or reference them or engage with them. So it has to be this stream of micropayments going out and through this activist space for anything to get done. And I don't know, that seems like it's probably not going to work. But so she objected to being in the document. Then they said, sorry, we're trying to remove it. But then they put her name on the fucking list as a signatory after that. And then,
and my favorite is Imani Gandhi, angry black lady. In response to this, she was like, her excuse was, she was like, "I really do feel terrible about non-contacting Marissa. I really should have. My only excuse is that I fell in love last month and lost my goddamn head. Don't excuse it, but maybe explain it." So it happens. You start dating someone, and then you put people's names onto documents that they've never seen.
I picture like the writing of this letter and this contentious "We Are the Left" movement. It's like a trading floor.
Because they're all paying each other for
buy,
their emotional labor.
Buy, sell.
Oh my god, the derivatives market is going to be off the chain.
So the next big fuck-up that they tried to remove in the letter was trans issues. And then trans people got angry at them for including them, and they had, or some of the language that they used.
Well,
they
said that trans men are victims of misogyny, which yeah. is offensive because they're
and not
they
only
are
that,
men,
but,
so they can't be... victims of misogyny. That got them mad.
Also, hilariously, an anti-trans feminist named Kathy Brennan approvingly retweeted the We Are the Left manifesto. And then that causes a problem. If you put anything out in the public...
It's funnier than yeah. that. So she liked the manifesto, but then she was tweeting in defense specifically of Angry Black Lady, saying, you know, people need to stop attacking this, you know, lesbian woman, and then saying, you know, the people were misrepresenting her history as a litigator for mortgages. And then the We Are the Left Twitter retweeted her, which means that it was probably Angry Black Lady who did it.
Yeah.
And she didn't know who Kathy Brennan is, even though she's probably the most infamous TERF on the internet. And then, of course, everyone lost it, and then they went into full drill, I'm trying to remove it mode.
TERF meaning the term for feminists who can't stand...
exclusive radical feminism, yeah.
Fucking hate trans
Yeah, they
people.
Hate trans women because...
document that was supposed to be about how we need to include every strand of you know, minority voice immediately retweets this person whose
exactly
basic claim to fame is that they want to exclude. That's what the E in TERF stands for. Trans people from any kind of movement, and then, oh shit, never mind. And why not over any kind of ideology, not over any point of doctrine, not over any point of an activist's thing, like we're going to do X, Y, or Z? No, protecting the personal brand and reputation of one of the signatories, because that's all this is. It's all brand building and brand... when these people talk about identity politics... we've got to say that the idea that, you know, people's identities, their race identity, their gender identity, their sexual identity, that is an important part of them. It is a thing that needs to be represented in any movement for equality. I don't think anybody here disagrees with that. But what these people are doing, when they say identity, they mean literally their personal identity, their personal individual identity, as in
it's what's going on in their brain at any given moment.
For change has to specifically cater to me as a person.
This is an excellent strategy for building a broad base of political support.
It's literally impossible. It will never work. It can't work. It is a recipe
for these people
to get their Amazon wish list fulfilled and nothing else.
To that end, I just want to read now a couple of the corrections that were issued after. They're fucking fantastic. We mentioned the one about they said that they said people in the gender trans men could be targeted for misogyny, which got them in trouble. I want to read a couple of the other corrections. Correction. One of our editorial and organizing team personally requested a few edits and mentioned specifically regarding sex work and sex workers after the publication. We agreed to those changes as a team, and the letter now includes them. So they left out sex workers. They left out sex workers out of the original in the original letter. Next correction. Two readers individually and separately requested spotlights be given to biphobia and sizism, with both people citing these issues' larger invisibility in progressive communities. We've incorporated that here with an additional spotlight on biphobia and our list of oppressions straight people should and must address. Sorry.
Oh my God.
I'm not laughing at bisexual people here or biphobia, but this is the best one, the next correction. At the request of a reader, at the end of this graph on white women and Hugo Schweitzer has been adjusted to from, quote, had white women been more willing to listen to women of color and more willing to speak out, to had white women been more willing to listen to women of color and more willing to speak out against their oppressions.
And
let's not forget that these people
specifically were down with Hugo Schweitzer for a long fucking time. And this entire thing is, to a degree, like basically covering their tracks as having supported him and defended him
when he was a pretty well-known
scumbag.
As you were discussing, Matt, about the inherent problems of having identity mean identity, like your personal individual consciousness and whatever is going on in your head at any given moment. Someone wrote a response to this. This was a Deep Blue on Medium. Someone wrote a response to this. In the final paragraph, I think they capture this quite nicely about why this utterly predictable disaster happened. And he's, they write, one might wonder why this happened, why the outrage, why the infighting, why the mounting demands for revisions and repairs. One might then consider the source. If you get some 100 people together for the sole purpose of demanding that they each be respected and acknowledged in their unique individual identities, and underwrite the demand with an assertion that any failure to honor such a unique individual identities is rank bigotry, you shouldn't be surprised when your signatories and audience act accordingly. And maybe this left is even happy to oblige, to, quote, learn, grow, do better, and clean its own house. So that's exactly what happened here. It's just like, these people are claiming to want to, like, be of the left and engage with politics seriously. But as we mentioned, like, the trap that they're always going to fall into over and over again is when, like, you make it impossible to make any political statement that appeals to any large group of people, because if you make any statement that in their worldview or in their personal life that they feel they're being excluded from for whatever reason, then how are you ever gonna? That's not politics. Like, you can't do politics that way.
I mean, when I think leftist politics, the history of the broad left trying to create a movement for equality for all people and justice, I think of a bunch of people fanatically obsessed with their own personal gain and advancing in a capitalist order. That's what I think of.
I mean, you know, and like that's not the thing. And like, I don't want it to seem like we're making fun of people who care about, like, you know, trans issues or any of these things like that. Like, that's not the point. We're making fun of the people behind this, because the fact of the matter is they're not very left wing. They really aren't very left wing.
The thing that unites them is that they were all supporting Clinton in the primary, and none of these issues were things that separated Sanders and Clinton.
Yeah, exactly.
There was no policy difference between Sanders and Clinton on any of these issues.
So yeah, that's we are the left. We stand tall. That's all I can think about when I saw We Are the Left was just the Scientology video.
I hope they break it, and like this letter is just, it's corrected every year for the next 50. Like, after World War III, after like Peter Thiel makes his Ocean Cities and like the Midwest becomes irradiated, they're still on like correction 3,500,072. We improperly misgendered the warlord of the southern United States and Mexico.
So, yeah, we are the left, folks. Before we close out the show today, I do want to do some Chapo mail, some reader-listener mail. I know I said we were going to do that again, so I picked out some ones. Let's dip into the Chapo mailbag. First question here comes from Timothy Bradley. The subject is, I don't know, Jill Stein. Timothy writes, I'm out of it, but my question is, I'm worried that when I vote Jill Stein, it's a dumb question, but will voting third party really affect the outcome of the general? We got some other questions about how we feel about Green Party or Gary Johnson or voting third party in a Clinton-Trump election. What do you guys feel? How do you guys feel about that?
I think that due to a lot of structural issues and the way that American politics is set up from a constitutional point, and I just don't think that third parties have any real hope, as it stands now, of affecting anything. I mean, the fact is that your vote does not matter. Let's just get that out of the way right now. People fetishize their vote to an insane degree because it's all they have. Because we've been so depoliticized as a people that if we want to think of ourselves as politically engaged, other than, you know, tweeting or Facebook updates, all we can do materially is vote. And so that one act gets this incredibly oversized importance placed on it. But even if you live in a swing state, come on, your individual, because we're not talking about movements. We're talking about an individual choice. Even in a swing state, your individual choice to vote isn't going to matter. So it really comes down to just like aesthetics and preferences. I mean, I'm not going to vote for Jill Stein because the Green Party seems like a fucking joke. I mean, there is maybe a chance of challenging the Democrats from the left, but it has to begin at the grassroots. The fact that these dipshits don't do anything, and then every 4 years they trot out some homeopath to run for
president. Yeah, it doesn't seem like they...
I mean, what is that other than just a fucking ego stroke? There's no seriousness behind it.
I mean, I think I can sort of speak just generally as a general statement for Chapo Trap House. I don't care who you vote or not vote for. Like, we are not in the business of demanding that you vote for a candidate or not vote for any candidate, lest you be a sellout neolib chill. Like, telling someone to vote or not vote, in my opinion, in a presidential election is like telling someone not to pray or something. Like, to do whatever
exactly.
your conscience...
Yeah. Do what you want to do.
Do whatever your conscience requires, but...
As I've said, and I'm not kidding, I'll probably write in drill.
But for me personally, I think Jill Stein and the Green Party is for goofies.
Yeah, no, I mean... If leftism is sold to any meaningful extent in this country, it's not going to be from the perspective of healing crystals and chiropractic and other fucking middle-class weirdness. So,
I mean, the guy who like organizes the workers at a factory or a Walmart isn't rolling up on a recumbent bike.
But yeah. Like I said, if you want to vote for Jill Stein, go ahead.
Do you?
Yeah,
doesn't matter.
And if you want to vote for Gary Johnson, all I'll say is, why the fuck didn't you vote for Rand Paul in the first place when you had a chance? Yeah.
He had a hilarious video where he's trying to get Bernie supporters. Did you see that?
No, I didn't.
He put it on Facebook.
I didn't.
Hello, youth. You were down with Bernie Sanders. Well, let me hip you to the flavor of Gary Johnson.
Well,
and of course, it's all, you know, I'm against the drug war. That's bad. I've always been against the drug war. Of course, nothing about, I think you should all, like, die in a fucking, you know, parched hellscape because you can't.
By the way, when Gary Johnson was governor of New Mexico or whatever, he was a very strict law and order governor. He put a lot of people in jail.
Yeah, these assholes always make this fucking Saul on the Road to Damascus conversion after they no longer have any fucking power.
Like Bob Barr.
But yeah,
you
like
Bob Barr.
At that, they had a libertarian town hall. And Gary Johnson was talking about raising the retirement age to 75. So, yeah, rally Bernie supporters around the idea of work till you fucking drop, you fucking peons.
Okay, moving from the political to the personal, this next question comes from David, who writes, Dear Chapo, since I started listening to your show, I have become amazingly wealthy and successful, but unfortunately I haven't been having any luck with the ladies. How do you guys pick up chicks? And if you've already shagged a bird, how do you keep her happy? Sincerely, Danny. Danny, great question. You're asking the right source. And if there's one thing I know about, it's pulling birds, mate. You guys have any pickup advice?
I mean, look, we, in the Chapo Guide relationships, we're usually against anything that saps your life force. Like, we think if you jack off, you should retrograde ejaculate it back into your colon to preserve chi. If you even need to do that, if you're so weak that you need that gratification, if you need the companionship of any type of romantic partner, like, I think you're already fighting a losing battle. But if you just can't help yourself, you can do things like you can conspicuously display yourself reading a Ta-Nehisi Coates book or the We Are the Left manifesto to, like, let women know that you're with it. Just do that in public. Conspicuous literacy. I'm really just saying this to the men, but really who listens to us but men, so you get it.
Like, as Felix has stated, our official policy is that we are against sapping the male essence in any way. It's okay that if you listen to the show, women will desire you, but we recommend against giving them your essence. But, you know, if you can't stick to that Valsell lifestyle that we subscribe to, our motto is, we didn't coin this, but we subscribe to it, always horny, never thirsty. I think if you can live by those guidelines, I think you will do well in the ladies' department.
It is by will alone I slap my boner up against my stomach to make it soft. It is by will alone that I put it back into my sweatpants. It is by will alone that I internalize my blue ball pain.
Okay. Next question. This is from Soul Junk. They write, does Matt remember when he said a lesser of two eagles instead of a lesser of two evils? Because I remember. I think he also called it Troppo Chop House one time. Thanks. These are my favorite memories. Matt, do you remember that?
Those are lies. The traitor Gulan is everywhere. Even though his coup has been defeated, he's still attempting to undermine those who uphold justice and development. And I call on all people to refute these lies when they hear them from the dogs.
Next question from Clarence Tuppins. Not a real name, I'm sure.
Tuppins the bag.
Writes, any thoughts about the irony Stalinists at the Rhizone sharing your premium episodes on their Hidden Files subforum? No idea what that sentence means at all.
Yeah, no I thoughts no about idea it. What the fuck you're talking about.
I have no thoughts.
I think what he's saying is that the online communists who hate us are listening to our...
They're pirating our premium shows
for free.
All right, I love it, fuckers. Dude. If our premium shows show up on the Pirate Bay, I feel like it means like we've made it.
Yeah, what can you do?
Next,
maybe they'll fucking learn something.
Yeah, bitch.
Next question from JC Balsita, John Balsita. Definitely also not a real name. I'm glad people aren't using their real names to talk to us, by the way. He writes, Loyal Chapo Head here with a question for Will Menaker. Thank you, JC. The question is, who is the weird-looking short foreign dude in the vines you post? He is usually punching or slapping someone. One video even showed him shooting a gun. He is extremely lit and seems to be a powerful fourth. Is he a gray wolf or otherwise on our side, or is he a great foe that we will have to face in the future? JC, excellent question. He very well might be a gray wolf, but in the original sense. The extremely lit, short foreign man who you have seen on my Twitter feed in vines slapping people and shooting guns is none other than the extremely powerful Turkish dwarf Kozkal Baba. He is a vine star, and as I said, he is a Turkish dwarf who mainly is just kind of really angry and just slaps and punches people all the time. I don't know if he's a foe, but goddamn, I don't want him as an enemy. I hope he's on our side.
I wonder what he was doing during the coup.
That's a gross slap. He's probably like lording over the captured soldiers, just whipping them and slapping their stupid traitorous Gulan faces. So yeah, everyone follow Kozkal Baba. Final question from Augusto Dabos. Please explain the election to me by comparing it with Metal Gear Solid 2. I have no other way of understanding it. Felix?
All right, baby. Okay. All right, so you got Gary Johnson. Gary Johnson, if Solid Snake is Ron Paul, Gary Johnson is Raiden, meaning that Gary Johnson is smooth genitals. He has been put in Ron Paul's place to complete his mission, but isn't aware that he's competing inside a simulation against Solid Snake, who is Donald Trump, and you have Hillary Clinton, who is Liquid Ocelot, meaning the Patriots are her big bank donors, and Sidney Blumenthal is Olga Kurlukovich. This places the crashing of Arsenal gear into Federal Hall as when Bill Clinton will say the N-word in October. Thank you.
Folks, this is the kind of analysis that you can only get from Chapo Trap House. Thanks again for all the letters. If I didn't get to them, your letter today, I apologize. We've gotten some actually very good emails that were longer, people telling us about that they're working on Bernie-inspired political campaigns, that they're a socialist organizer in Kentucky. Very cool stuff. We want to give those shout-outs. We want to respond to a lot of the things people say. I promise I'll do better. But if you want your letter read on the show, if you have a question for the Chapo mailbag, send it to us and put in the subject line on the email Chapo Mailbag so that I can pick those out quicker and more efficiently. So that about does it for episode 24. Just want to remind you guys that our live show in Philadelphia, unfortunately the t-shirts are now, those orders are closed, but tickets are still available. The link will be in the info when we post the show. So please come out in Philly on July 28th to see us and Street Fight live at the DNC. See ya.
Bye, everybody.
Bye. Here comes our railroad.
the Diva.